we'll begin with the following story. I remember when I was in ninth grade, so we were in, as an MTA, so it was a sheer of, 27, 28 boys, whatever you call 14-year-olds, and we were learning Gemara. I remember what Gemara did we learn freshman year? I don't believe this. We learned about Vassar. Okay. But one of the guys in the shir wanted to ask something of, related to sexuality somehow, and he starts raising the question, and he kind of like mumbles, the way, even man and woman, kind of thing. And our Rebbe, got into his face. It's like, what are you trying to say? And the kid's like, like man, the woman, the relations kind of thing. It's like, I don't understand. What are you trying to say? He's like, and the Rebbe says, what are you trying to say? Sex? And the kid's like, well, yeah. And the Rebbe's like, well, why didn't you just say it? Why did you just say the word? There's nothing wrong with saying the word sex. There's nothing wrong. It's a wonderful thing to say the words. And he ran into the hallway, and mind you, MTA was an all-boys school, and shouted up and down the hallway, sex, 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 sex. So I'm not really sure I'm still not sure, all these years later, what exactly he was trying to prove with that act. This is not like one of my crazy rebbeim. I have plenty of crazy rebbeim. Also, he was not one of those. He was very, very methodical, very, straight, and all of a sudden, like, we're all sitting there, what in the world is going on here? Like, what happened to our Rebbe? He all of a sudden became this different creature. So that I thought would be a good opening to discuss the issues tonight. I'm not sure, this is actually pretty difficult because I wasn't really able to find any real outline to go by. A couple of thoughts that I wanted to put out there, and I think we're able to somewhat come up with this year. There is a book, if one is interested. I was able to find sources, and I can't say outline, but some sources are put together nicely in a book here, Marital Intimacy, by someone named Rabbi Avram Peretz Friedman. There are some other books now out on the topic, although they are coming out now. They all begin in their introduction saying, like, we know there's no books like this yet, and it's very important for the following reasons. So it is important. It is important because that boy in ninth grade didn't really know how to express himself, and people do have the need. We'll talk about the physical aspect of expressing themselves, but just to discuss the topic and the various misconceptions that arise from it. So we're not going to methodically go through the halachos of it or go through the those kinds of things, but just an approach to the kedusha, the uniqueness and the the specialness that we attribute to human sexuality within Jewish religion. So it all of a sudden starts in the beginning. All in the beginning, Perek Beis, Pasuk Tafei, chapter 2, verse 25. So there's two versions of man's creation. Chapter 1 and chapter 2 are both versions, different versions of where Adam is created. The first time Adam is described as, and both of them have an expression of, there's an attachment of sexuality to it. There's attachment, puravu and milu esa'aris v'kivshua, you're going to be fruitful and multiply and conquer the world, as it appears in chapter 1. And chapter 2 is not expressed in that way, but it's an expression of loneliness, expression of Adam is lonely. And he's looking for companionship, and nothing seems to work for him to, for him to have as a companion, until finally he has Chava, and he sacrifices for Chava. He gives up for Chava. He gives up a piece of his body for Chava. The Torah seems to describe, and now he has a companion. And that story concludes, the end of chapter 2 concludes with the verse, Vayiyu shnehem arumim hadam v'ishto v'lo yisposhashu, that they were both naked, man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. So that's the last verse in chapter 2. Chapter 3, what does it mean that they weren't ashamed? So let's take a look at the commentator Rashi. I'll admit the translation is mine. I just whatever, but it says Shelo ayu yodim derech tznius lahavchin bin tovara. They didn't recognize a way of tznius, we'll say modesty, to distinguish between good and bad. V'afal pishenasna bo dea likros shemos. And even though Adam had been given the knowledge, the ability to name things. Why is that relevant here? But he was right, the Torah says that he met all of the animals and he named them all. So he was given that amount of wisdom. Lo natan bo yetzer hara ad achlo min ha'etz. He was not given what will translate as the evil inclination. He has a whole chapter in this book about what that means to have an evil inclination, but why that's not a very good term. I intend on saving that for, unless I think of a better topic, Shabbos Shuvah Drasha, which I've already thought of, entitled A Biography of the Yetzer Hara. So I've been collecting sources throughout the year, The Biography of the Evil Inclination. So we'll save that, how to translate, how to understand it for then, when I actually come up with something good to say about it. But he wasn't yet given the Yetzer Hara until he ate from the tree and received the Yetzer Hara and the ability to discern between good and evil. So what was he doing when not discerning, without this idea, without this Yetzer Hara, without this inclination, we'll say physical inclination? What were they? So they were naked. They were naked. In fact, the Torah seems to describe that without any effort, they were together. Yadauta, that he was with her. They had relations, and I'm not sure you even call it relations, but they procreated already right then at that time. Now, the next verse is all of a sudden the snake shows up. Right? And the snake convinces Chava to eat from this tree and to have this apple. And Eve convinces Adam to have from this apple. And God kind of comes looking for them. But before God comes looking for them, the Torah describes what was the first thing that they did after eating this apple. So the Torah describes that their eyes open wide. And they realize, lo and behold, we're naked. We're not wearing any clothing. And they immediately put on clothing. So that's what happened before God came to find them. So there's something deep is going on there, right? There's something with it's bothering me for a long time. What's going on there with the clothing? Why is that such a central part to the story? It seems to be like that's how we're measuring man's progress. Do they realize they're supposed to be wearing clothing yet, or are they? Do they not realize, etc.? So Rav Soloveitchik, I was only able to find on my computer screen, not in person, but in the book Family Redeemed. Does anybody hear of the book Family Redeemed by any chance? I'm going to kick myself for not trying to find the actual copy. But in the book Family Redeemed, Rav Soloveitchik has an essay where he points out that there's two types of what he calls busha. Right? People wear clothing out of busha. So busha is generally translated as embarrassment, or the requirement to hide, the need to hide something. So Soloveitchik points out that there's really two forms of busha. There's two things there's two reasons why a person would be embarrassed. We'll use the English word embarrassed. One is because they did wrong, because they sinned, and therefore we want to keep it hidden because the person is embarrassed that they sinned. And the second reason, that's category one, and that's probably what we're most used to. Embarrassed that we sinned, and Adam and Chava were embarrassed that they sinned. So that's why that they have to feel covered. So the other reason, however, and by the way, the term busha, lo yisposhishu, that is used in that verse that I put on the page. Right? There's the other way that to be, or the reason why would somebody would want to cover up, and that would be labeled as busha, the requirement to cover up, is because they wanted to remain mysterious. They wanted to remain closed to people on the outside. Something that is supposed to be maintain a veil of secrecy. So the term busha could apply to that as well. So one can look at the idea of sexuality and one can see that there's a possibility of both applying, at least within the Jewish religion. There's a possibility, we would assume. The reality is, although other traditions might not say it in this way, that both possibilities exist. You have the possibility to be embarrassed because it is something done was wrong, something that was done to take away Kedusha, to take away holiness from the world. On the other hand, it could be covered up because it is adding Kedusha to the world and it's something that is going to remain mysterious, quiet, and amongst oneself. So that is perhaps the introduction. It's the source for confusion, the idea that there's these two aspects of busha. There's these two aspects of, again, translated as ashamed, embarrassed, etc. But Rav Soloveitchik is pointing out that's really only that English term of embarrassed or ashamed is really only one side of the busha coin. The other side of the busha coin is to say, not embarrassed, not necessarily doing anything wrong, but rather it's something that whose secrecy should be maintained. And why should that be? Why would there be something whose secrecy should be maintained? So let's continue on. What could be? We could give in many introductions to basics of Jewish sexuality, introduction to Jewish sexuality, as much as about we don't believe in asceticism, which by the way is not such a simple comment to make. Maybe we'll talk about that another time. But Judaism is not an ascetic religion. Everybody points to the source of the Nazir, right? Why does a Nazir bring a Korban Chatas at the end of his Nazirship, right? A Nazir is somebody who has taken a vow to not come in contact with the dead and not to drink wine and to grow their hair long. They're the classic ascetic, right? So why does he have to bring a sin offering at the end of his time being an ascetic? So the Rambam is famous for saying, well, because Hashem gave us the ability to enjoy the world, and he has said, I'm not going to enjoy the world. So for denying yourself the enjoyment of the world, so therefore you have to bring a sacrifice, because you in a way you did something wrong. God gave you the world, and you refuse to enjoy it. Right? There aren't enough prohibitions in the Torah, I think the language is. There aren't enough things you can't do. You have to add on more things, so you should have done it. Right? Like the famous, I forget which Rebbe this is told about, but towards the end of his life, he said, we need to go take a trip to the Alps. Why do you need to go to the Alps? He says, because God created the Alps. He's going to ask me, Nu, what do you think of my Alps? So what am I going to have to? I'm going to have to figure out something. I'm going to answer him. How can I deny myself that idea? But there are many sources that lean the other way on that issue with the Nazir, with the paradigmatic ascetic. So those that say, no, why does he bring a sin offering? Because he was at a high level of holiness. Now he's not at a high level of holiness. So because he's stepping down, that's why he's bringing the sin offering. Right? That idea is very much part of our tradition as well. So many focus on that. Many focus on we're not an ascetic religion, and we aim to gain pleasure from this world, controlled pleasure from this world. That's part of what we'll speak about, but I don't think that that's the entire story. The Ramban, well, I'm not sure it's the Ramban. There is something out there called the Igeres HaKodesh, which literally means the Holy Letter. The Holy Letter can be found in Kisvei HaRamban, the book of the writings of the Ramban of Nachmanides. I do not have the resources or the ability to really research this. It seems like it's mostly acknowledged to not have been written by the Ramban, but it was written by somebody pretty special that lived during that century. Whether it was the Ramban or whether it was somebody else. So it begins with, it seems like this was an issue then, and if one learns the history of the time, asceticism was an issue during that time. And it rejects that. It rejects that idea. It says, "Aval inyan hu kmo shehashem yisparach hu tahor inayim maros bera." The idea is source number three, that God is pure to the eyes and everything, and maros bera and what can see evil? I'm not sure. Ein lafan of kilkul oginai v'hu bara. Ish v'isha, there is nothing in front of him that could be kilkel, that could be a destruction, or gnai, or an embarrassment, or bad. I'm not sure gnai is embarrassment, but degraded is probably a good term for gnai. V'hu bara, he created ish v'isha, he created man and woman, uvara kol eiver v'eiver shebehem, and he created every one of their limbs. V'hachinam al midchon asam, and he prepared what they have, and he wouldn't have created anything that is degraded. I mean, you can't look at the human and say, well, man is perfect, but he's got that imperfection, that the sexual drive is some amount, is something mounting to an imperfection within man, and it has to be corrected. Now, that seems like that is certainly part of what we'd call Western religious thought. In the Christian thought, that is part of the equation. But the Ramban is rejecting that. And this is kind of the main line that it's saying, we don't reject the idea that it's something that has to be kind of, ideally you wouldn't have to do it, but you know, what can we do? You're a human being, so at least, you know, put it within the confines of marriage, and that way you'll control it a little bit, and you can't be, you can't be a priest, whatever, and not everybody could be holy, etc. So at least confine it within the context of marriage. So Ramban is rejecting that. He's explicitly rejecting, or the Igaris HaKodesh is explicitly rejecting that idea. You can't say that anything that's created in this world is inherently evil. That goes against the doctrine of God creating everything. If everything is kind of a representation of HaKodesh Baruch Hu, so how could you turn around and say, well, but that is inherently evil? If it's created by God, so it can't be inherently evil. So that's the idea. So that's what he is presenting here. So then, what do we do with it? How does one deal with it then? Because there certainly are a long list of prohibitions that are certainly fit within the realm of human sexuality. So this story fits as a jumping off point for the rest. There is a Gemara in Menachos, a famous story in Menachos. It's really within the context of Hilchos Tzitzis, the laws of the strings that are worn, laws of Hilchos Tzitzis. So it tells the story of a Talmud Chacham, was a big Talmud Chacham. He was a good learner and everything, but he had this issue with he wanted to visit prostitutes. So he went to many, and eventually he went to one, and he found the one that he wanted to visit, etc. And he went to her, and the Torah and the Gemara gives this description of what the room was like, and there were multiple beds, and this whole story there, all of it could possibly be representing different imagery. And it describes that he was with this woman, and they were he was committed to following through on the act. Until, as he was taking off his shirt, his tzitzis swiped across his face, and he realized, "Oy gewalt, I can't believe what has this gotten me to," and immediately said to him, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to follow through on this idea," and he left. So before he left, so she grabbed him and said to him, and that's where I picked up here this line here, Amra lo, she said to him, Eini manichacha ashatomrali mashemecha. I'm not going to let you go until you tell me what your name is, umashem yirech, what the name of your city is, umashem rabcha, what your Rebbe's name is, umashem midrashecha, and what the name of the yeshiva is that you go to. So, I'm not sure too many people would want to give over that information, but I want to know the yeshiva that you go to where you're learning Torah now. So he wrote it to you, all right, he wrote it, Kasav v'nasa miyadah. So he wrote it down and gave it to her. So Amda v'chilka kol nechaseh, so the Gemara goes on to describe that she took all of her wealth. She was a very popular prostitute, so she took all of her wealth, divided amongst a couple of tax-deductible causes. Uvasil v'beis midrash shel Rebbe Chiya, and she came to the Rebbe Chiya's beis midrash, which is presumably where this Talmud was learning, this student was learning. So Amar lo, she said to him, Rebbe, tziva alai v'yasuni giyoris. She said to him, please tell me what I need to do in order to convert. So Amar lo, he told her, biti, shema inecha nasata bi'achas mina talmidim. So she said to him, well, maybe the reason you're converting is because you want to marry one of my students, which is a no-no. He's saying it in a bad way. I mean, that maybe, how do I know that you're really sincere? Maybe the only reason you're converting is because you found this per man that you want to marry. So what does she also? So she took out her little letter and gave it to him, seemingly implying, also telling him the story as to how she got a hold of this letter, this name. So Amar Allah, so he said to her, L'chi zachi b'mekhecha. He said, okay, go and take your acquisition. He said, it must be, if this is really your story, it must be that you're doing this altruistically, that you're doing this lishma, for the good purposes. And osan matzo shehetzielo be'iser, hetzielo be'heter. And then the very bedclothes that she had spread for him for illicit purposes, she now spread out for him in permissible purposes. I think there might be a story there. I look around. I remember hearing that that became, that was used as the chuppah But not that they became, they're still bed sheets, but now they're being used in a permissible fashion. So I think the story illustrates the idea, right? There's one act, and it could be used in the extremes of possibilities. It could be used in a degraded act, or it could be used in the positive fashion, which is what she ultimately uses it for. In the same materials, I mean, the same bed sheets, the same objects that one could use in one way could be used in a positive direction in the other way. So, great. So we can see that we're not ascetics. We agree that man should enjoy pleasure in this world. B, we have the idea that there's nothing that God could possibly have created that would be considered inherently evil, right? And the third thing that we see is in the same things, the same objects that could be used for degraded purposes, lignai, could also be used for positive purposes. But you're still left with, and this is where a lot of shirim, I think, leave people off, you're still left with, well, why? Like, why is that? Why is it done that way? Why is that? Why is that? Why don't we just have things that are evil, have things that are positive? Why is it that same thing, that this description from this story would be used in that way? Why would it be that would be the way that we're going to be creating people in the future? Right? That's our method of procreation. Like, why are things done in that particular way? So that's what I'd like to address going forward. But any questions thus far? That's kind of part one, yes.
And if it's not relevant, just tell me, and I'm fine with that. But I don't understand why the letter that she showed the rabbi changed his mind.
Right, so I would assume it was the story along with it, that your Talmud, again, the context of that statement in the Talmud is there's about a page and a half of describing the amazing powers of tzitzis. That's what it's about. So that's really what the emphasis is. Look how amazing tzitzis is, that caused him to turn around. So I think she was so impressed by the power of mitzvos that it could cause a personal change in such a deep way and at such a difficult time that she wanted a part of that. That's my impression. Okay, so Rav Soloveitchik has a line. I want to say, hey, why is this an ideal? There is a line in the Zohar which I was not able to pick out, but there is a line in the Zohar that the Bris Mila, meaning the circumcision, and the Bris Mila is part of this discussion, but the Bris Mila and that which it guards against, meaning it's a guard against marital, against illicit behavior, against immoral behavior, right? That is a paradigm for the rest of mitzvahs. That is a model for the rest of mitzvahs. What does that mean? Why is this? I mean, think about just this class, right? We have five sessions. God, right? God, Shabbos, mitzvahs, tefillah, and sexuality. So why? Sexuality is one of the top five things within Yiddishkeit. So I kind of felt a little guilty about that. But I found this line is alright. Well, yeah, it's a paradigm for all of the mitzvahs. And keep in mind, last week, as we were talking about the idea of mitzvahs, so this was something that we kept touching on. It's like, well, maybe we'll discuss it next week. So why is sexuality a paradigm for mitzvahs? So Soloveitchik has the following idea in the Sefer Ubikashtem Misham. I believe this is his essay that he wrote, I believe in Yiddish, actually. It appeared in English for a long time, was studied, you know, by like people like Rabbi Cohn, and not by people like me. And I found that it was published in English pretty recently, and this is written by Rav Soloveitchik. Many of the books that look like this, in this style, are not written by him. They're kind of collections of essays or collections of shirim that were put together by students. This, I believe, is a translation of his original work. So he writes the following idea. The purpose of the halachic imperative is not to label man's sensual body as impure and thus reject it, but to purify it and to draw it closer to God. Okay, so this is already the next step, right? We kind of discussed the first half of that sentence, right? Not labeling it impure and rejecting it, but the drawing closer to God part is still a little bit difficult to understand. So how is that happening? So is the halachic factor, when applied to pleasure-filled, self-satisfied, fleshly existence, an existence driven by untamed instincts and made insensitive by savage lusts, bestows the glory of the Shekhinah on the human body. Wow, how's that happening? How is the Shekhinah, how is God's presence being placed on the human body? So he explains, the Lach enjoins man to take no less pleasure than the hedonists in the glory and the splendor of creation. The pleasure of halachic man, however, is refined, measured, and purified. The enjoyment of one who has penetrated the furnace of lust and understood its nature. It contains something of the ascetic attitude of the skeptic, who has tasted his fill of the world but not found satisfaction, as well as something of the moral discipline of the man of duty, who is afflicted by his drives and manages to overcome them. The Torah has never forbidden man the pleasures of the world, nor does it demand asceticism or self-torture. And what Salavitchik here is saying is that, and is that if somebody, yes, the Torah wants to know, Hashem wants to know, why didn't you take a look at my Alps? Why didn't you take a look at my world? Why didn't you gain from the enjoyments of the world? I put them here for you to benefit from. Why didn't you benefit from them? But what he's also adding in is, but I don't want you to be subservient to them. I want you to be the master of them. So he says, yes, one should be gaining the pleasures. One should be seeking that the pleasures of this world, but not that we are running after them, but rather that we are in control of them. And the area of sexuality, he says, is a primary example of that. Maybe the primary example of it. There perhaps is no greater. Just look at most scandals, most downfalls of people that one hears about in the news. A lot of it has to do with sexuality. Probably more than 50%. Which means what? That the draw of sexuality is greater than the draw of money. It might be. It could very well be. And yet, that is the way. If one can get on top of it, one can control it, one can be the master of it, so then you'll get the pleasure, but yet still have the knowledge that you're in control. It will no longer be guilty on being dragged along, but rather it becomes a very self-empowering kind of thing. So that is what that's the idea of Salvation is adding. He adds on the next page, he said, what's the other area that probably has the most mitzvot connected to it? The most commandments are probably connected to what? What do we think of that? At least, I don't know, positive, negative. An area of human nature is?
Eating.
Yeah. He says eating. And we normally think about eating as, well, I have to eat things with a heksher, or I have to eat things with a symbol on it, or I can't mix meat and milk, right? So those are a few of the things. But one can start thinking about, imagine life during the time of the temple period, or when living in Israel, when everything that gets farmed has to be tithed, and not just tithed one way, but tithed like five times over. And part of the field has to be left blank. And you're not allowed to eat from a tree. I'm learning with the sixth grade girls in class of the halachos of Orla, which is the law that you're not allowed to take a tree, you're not allowed to eat fruit from a tree for the first 3 years, and the fourth year has to be brought to Yerushalayim, and the fifth year, so then, if assuming you wait long enough, the Torah says you'll get a bracha, and concludes with the words, Ani Hashem Elokeichem. So one of the girls asks, what is that, like, what does God have to do with this? Why is also God sticking in, by the way, I'm God? So Rashi there comments, that's why it's good that we had iPads, because I had it in front of me, Rashi there comments that, why? Because only God can make that promise. That if you do this, so it will be for a bracha, it will be for a blessing for you. But mitzvah after mitzvah within the Torah has to do with food. The Korban Pesach itself, right? Not eating over the course of Yom Kippur. All of those laws, right? I don't know, probably 100 mitzvahs are out there at least having to do with eating, if not more. Right? So at the next page of this book, he points out, why is that? Well, that's perhaps the second most primal drive of man, and that is to eat. So yes, you eat, and you should enjoy it. The Torah recommends that you eat on a regular basis, right? And it even recommends that you enjoy what you eat on a regular basis, but also to be in control of them, also to be in control of what one eats. Right, that's also part of the deal, and you hear, I mean, especially if he comes a big, it's a, it's, you know, it, the obesity epidemic, right? That is out there, and even amongst, I'm not sure it used to be as big an issue amongst the Orthodox clientele because there was nothing to eat, but now when everything has become available, really everything has become available. It tastes. There was somebody that I worked with on conversion in Phoenix. You know, the fellow who's been here a few times, Mr. Parisi. So he, we once had him over. Actually, I remember when it was. When we were moving from Phoenix, he came along with Rabbi Liebman to our house to help me pack up all my books one morning, which is quite a job. And Chava made breakfast. So we had the vegetarian, the Morning Star bacon strips. So Chava made that, and Bill said that. It's pretty close. He said, this is as close as I've had in a couple of years since, you know. So, you can have everything. So it's almost no longer, that challenge is not as there, at least not in this country as much anymore. But the challenge is still there, to be in control of what you eat rather than having the food control you. So that's what Soloveitchik is pointing out here, that is the and by the way, the Rambam, Maimonides, in his 14 books, and he discusses his 14 books of law, so there's the book of holidays, and there's the book of damages, and there's the book of sacrifices, and right, and then there's the book of holiness. What is contained within the book of holiness? Two main categories: the laws of sexual matters, both prohibited and both permissible as well as prohibited, as well as the laws of what you eat, hilchos ma'achalos asuros, as well as the laws of shechita. All of those laws are contained within one book. What does one have anything to do with the other? So they're also contained within one page in the Sefer Uvikashta Mishan. So they both have to do with the same thing. That yes, we tell you to go for it, but to be in control of what you're going for, both in the sexual realm as well as in the food realm, the enjoyment realm. So that is perhaps reason A why it is the paradigm for all mitzvahs, right? Mitzvahs is all about capitalizing on the world, recognizing, you know, what are we supposed to be doing in this world, and mitzvahs, commandments that we do, end up being a very empowering thing when one thinks about it that way, as we spoke about last week. The second aspect, perhaps going a little bit deeper within the idea of sexuality, is also why does it make one, I mean, in a way you're never more godlike than one is involved in sexuality, one is involved in marital relations for the purpose of having children. Right? You're have an opportunity. The Torah itself says, not the Gemara itself, is you're partnering with God. Right? It's not going to be a kid unless you're doing that, and it's not going to be a kid unless God is helping you. Right? There's three partners within the making of every child: the father, the mother, and God Himself. And in a way, you're the most godlike when being involved in that act. So why would that be? So we started talking about this last week, the idea of mitzvos, that mitzvos are not just things that I have to do when I should just feel like, well, I'm patterned to do it, I'm programmed to do it, and it's not really part of what I'm thinking to do. But rather, it's about a choice, that everything that one does is supposed to, I'm choosing in order for it to be good. Right, that was that statement that we discussed within Maimonides, that a person shouldn't say this food is disgusting and I'm never, you know, I meat and milk eating together is disgusting. I would never want anything to do with that. Rather say I would like to eat it, but I can't do it because Hashem commanded me not to. I mean, one has to demonstrate the choice of the choice of abstaining. So Rabbi Aaron gives the following mashal. Last week he talked about the child who is learning how to be potty trained. This week we'll talk about the husband who is being asked to take out the garbage. Right. So he gets a call. His wife goes down there. Honey, can you please take out the garbage? So he has a couple possible responses that he could give to the all-powerful wife, right? Possible answer number one that he could give is
later.
Well, I was going to say later, and I would say is that that you'll do it later or that you're not going to do it later?
When I'm ready, I'll do it.
Okay. So answer number one is the negative answer, either later or no. I'm not doing it. I take out the garbage every week. Why don't you take out the garbage for a change, right? So that's answer number one that a person can give. Answer number two that can give, if somebody doesn't have as much guts as Joel, would be what?
Yes.
Whatever you say, honey, right? Whatever you say, honey. That is answer number two. Now, are either of those the correct answer? So, or the ideal answer? So, when the answer is yes, honey, right? So, let's put it that way. Why is that not the best answer? So we think about why that would not be the ideal answer.
Because you were requested, you didn't do it freely of your own volition.
I'm not sure I would go with leave the requested part out of it.
Okay.
But you're right that you're not doing it freely out of your own volition. Rather, you feel a man feels that I am giving something up of myself. In order to do that, like the child who feels that I'm giving up my freedom and my spontaneity by being forced to use the restroom and not just go in my diaper, right? So too the husband is going to feel that I'm giving up my freedom because I'm stuck doing this chore on behalf of my wife, right? So a person has given up of themselves, which is part of the big challenge of mitzvahs. I mean, I deal with adolescents. I'm not sure if the 6th, 7th, 8th graders qualify as adolescents. I'm not sure. 14, 15, I thought is like adolescent. But that's who I'm dealing with, right? And that's a big challenge, right? Why am I stuck listening to him? Why am I stuck doing that? If you feel that you're giving up part of yourself every time that you have to do part of that commandment, right? So then you don't feel so good about doing them. If you answer no, by the way, so no is just, you might be establishing yourself, but you're not really... It's not necessarily a great answer because you're going to end up sleeping on the couch, right? That's not a great answer. What is really the correct answer under those circumstances? So the answer is yes, honey, I'll do it. But not perhaps whatever you say, yes, and you think to yourself, I'm not doing this because she's making me do it, and by me doing it, I'm sacrificing a piece of my individuality. Rather, what is the reason that I'm following through on that request? Because I realize that, you know, that we're working together, we are in a way one flesh, one soul, one however we want to describe that, and if her desire, if my wife has this desire, it's not in violation of my individuality to be following through on that desire. Rather, it is a fulfillment of my individuality. If she wants it, then I want to follow through on it, not because she wants and I have to do what she says, but of course if she wants it, then I want to do it as well. Right? Everybody got that? Same thing would be with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? It can't just be I'm doing this mitzvah because otherwise God's going to be very angry at me. I have to, and I'm going to sacrifice my individuality on behalf of God. Rather, it's I'm being commanded these mitzvahs, but I've been commanded them by the very energy source that is giving me my very being. And if I'm being told to do that to help my energy source, then it's probably not just in that energy source's interest; it's in my interest. Right? If a light bulb is told to turn on by flipping the switch and having the light bulb turn on, and the light bulb doesn't feel I'm sacrificing my freedom will, my bechira chafshis by turning on. Rather, the light bulb realizes that is my individuality. That is going to be the greatest demonstration of myself, is that I turn on when I'm presented with the opportunity of this electricity that is running through me. So the same thing fits within the language of the Shulchan Aruch. There are a couple of halachos within this realm. There is a section in Shulchan Aruch entitled Hilchos Tznius. It's found in the section of Aruch Chaim. It's after the laws of Maariv, after the laws of saying Shema and goes to sleep, there is a section titled Hilchos Tznius, which are the laws of marital relations. And amongst them is that one is looking to please the other one. That one is looking to assist in the other one. Because why is that? Because one realizes that by assisting the other one, by giving pleasure to the partner, that is the ultimate, that is the greatest fulfillment, the greatest demonstration of my ability in this world. Not just to gain satisfaction for myself, but to grant satisfaction to the other one, and that ultimately gives me the greatest satisfaction when I'm giving to that other person. So that perhaps is a further, a deeper reason why this is that idea of the Zohar, why it is a paradigm for all mitzvos. Because all mitzvos, I have to realize that by me giving, by me helping out, by me following through on what will help the other person, that's not a sacrifice of my individuality, but rather it is the greatest expression of my individuality. So that is part number two. Any questions so far? And move on to part number three. We're good? All right, taking out the garbage, that we got that parable, that's a little difficult to have. Right? All the men are now going to know, right? When we're asked, right? We can even mutter to ourselves, you know, if we ask, what are we muttering? No, I'm just muttering to myself that I'm not doing this only because you're doing it and I'm sacrificing my individuality, but I realize this is the greatest fulfillment of my individuality because really we're considered like one nefesh, one soul together, and if you want it, then that's certainly within my will as well. That's what the muttering will be from now on, I'm sure. Right? Okay. And then the third idea is of recognizing God's nature in all of this is the attraction that is felt, the pull towards within the sexual realm and within the relationship realm, within this area, is not just an earthly desire. I mean, that's not what we believe. It is, every desire we have, Kabbalah teaches, is really a demonstration of our desire to become close to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So if somebody is attracted to beauty, so it is not just I have some kind of thing within me that I'm attracted to beauty, but rather it is I'm attracted to the demonstration of the God's demonstration of beauty that He has placed on this world, right? And that is actually that is healthy. Now the problem is Rabbi Aaron has a very nice story that he tells that he one time actually had. Some of his stories aren't always true, but this one might be. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. He said he had a world-class model that he had at his house on a Friday night dinner. So he picked her up at the Kotel. He lives in the Old City. And he walks her to his home in the Old City. And he's on his way home. He's thinking about, oh, who else is coming for Friday night dinner tonight? Oh, there's Shlomi and Yassel and the rest of the chevra from the yeshiva who's coming by. And he realized this is going to be interesting. So he said he walked into the room and like these yeshiva guys who were waiting for him like fell off their chairs. And he's always like, wow, what happened? They realize, oh yeah, I have a guest with me. And you know, the guys are kind of like, you know, after having their heads in a Gemara for an entire week, so all of a sudden being confronted with this is a little bit challenging. And he realized, you know, we might have trouble starting a conversation about the Parsha at the meal. So they go through Kiddush, and they go through Amotzi, and one of the guys turns to this woman and asks her a question. And she starts talking, and he says, all of a sudden, as soon as she starts talking, the energy just gets sapped out of the room. And all of a sudden, the guys kind of like turn away from her and say, well, how about we discuss this week's Torah portion instead? So what was going on there? So he explained is that, yes, what was the attraction of her originally? The attraction was God's manifestation of beauty within her. And we're attracted to God's manifestations in this world. That's what we are as people, as divine beings, as those made in Tzelem Elokim, those made in the image of God. But there's many other demonstrations of God in this world. God's demonstration of intellect, God's demonstration of humor, God's demonstration of personality, God's demonstration, all those things. And all of that goes into a package. So as soon as it became clear that she was not going to be demonstrating God, you know, God's intellect in this world. So the power and the energy that was coming from that kind of God sapped away. And the same thing works in the opposite way as well. If somebody, dating somebody perhaps not so, you knock on the door to pick up a girl, and all of a sudden, you know, you see her and say, oh, I came on behalf of my brother to tell you that he can't make it tonight. But whatever. Then you take her out, and you a half hour, you say, okay, a half hour later, an hour later, whatever, and you realize an hour later that maybe she doesn't look the same way as she did before. And the same way works women towards men as well. Also, maybe the person is a little bit more attractive than I thought before. Why is it working that way? Because maybe what we generally perceive as God's manifestation of beauty may not be present, but the manifestation of the intellect, the manifestation of sense of you, or all the other things, or spirituality that could be brought forth within a person, all of a sudden becomes apparent, and that person becomes attractive again. That person becomes attractive not just for the physical reasons, but for the other reasons as well. So that, if one, and that's really what this whole the whole five-part series was about. That it's all about, everything that we do is about recognizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in the world and being Mekadosh Shem Shamayim, sanctifying the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, recognizing that that we all have a role to play, recognizing that everybody has something to add, everybody has a role to do within this world that can be brought forth within it's brought out within from a shir about sexuality, but it was also, we pretty much ended this way with every year as well, that we have something that we have to offer. There's something that we have to bring forth that we were placed in this world to do. So we could go on and discuss further. Well, what happens if I don't fulfill my role? How does that work? How does that play out? Can I choose to go against the will of the Kodesh Baruch? What does that do to God? Does that really work? Well, that perhaps is perhaps for another time, but the positive aspect is that we have a job to do within this world, and I think within the context of Yiddishkeit is going to be the greatest fulfillment of that job, in which way that we will fill our greatest fulfillment as well. All right, so thank you, especially those that made it through all 5 weeks, which is many of you. So yashar koach, good job, and we'll see. Where this leads us, we'll see what's next. Right. Any questions?
Thank you.
Good.